Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there. Kevin McCarthy and Joe Biden cut a deal. Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump at war, at least on Twitter. And how old is too old? We'll discuss all this more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by Noah Rothman, the sage of authenticity, was Jim Garrity, and the notorious MBD, Michael Brendan Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsor this episode is the Free the Economy podcast from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. More about that in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. If you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So, Jim Garrity, we have a debt deal. And as always, the most important question is not what this means for the future of the country, but whether our predictions were correct. And I think most of us, when I asked about this last couple of months, said Republicans would get something. I think maybe there were a few nothings at the outset of the process, but certainly after McCarthy managed to pass a bill through the House, it was clear they were going to get something. An inadequate something, and that's what we've gotten. There's a cut here in the non-defense discretionary budget, a cut, narrow slice of the entirety of federal spending. 24 is going to be something like the same level as 22, although there's some argument over that. Republicans got some enhanced work requirements on food stamps. There's some permitting reforms, not what they were seeking, but improvements, and then also there's some incentives for Congress to actually do its job and pass appropriations bills and avoid these massive, egregious, end-of-the-year omnibus bills. What do you make of it?
I realize the current tastes in punditry are that I'm supposed to find this the best thing ever or the worst thing ever. Kevin McCarthy would certainly appreciate it if I came out and said, this is the best deal, you know, everybody should go out and pass this thing immediately. I think it's a pretty good deal. It's an okay deal. It's not great, but there was only a certain amount of leverage that House Republicans had in this process. I think the aspect that I find most interesting, and that I was writing about late last week, was the degree to which House Democrats and even Senate Democrats felt like they were completely shut out of the negotiating process by President Biden. Up until the deal was announced late Saturday night, they had no idea what was in there. They had no idea what concessions Biden was willing to make. They had no idea what he was absolutely adamant that were going to be kept in there. And there was real frustration. And you saw institutions like the Washington Post and Politico and places like that saying, Kevin McCarthy is winning or did win the messaging war. Oh, I'm sorry, former New York Jets tackle Jumbo Elliott doesn't like when we say messaging war. Apparently, it's too martial. It's so basically, we should say the messaging competition. This is Jumbo Elliott of the Monday night unusual thing that happened, not the Monday night miracle. But anyway, in the messaging.
So he's literally come out against messaging war.
Yes, he tweeted, he responded to something I tweeted. Ironically, I was quoting NBC News saying that, you know, McCarthy had won the messaging war. But again, like I think, you know, in McCarthy, for all of his flaws, and he's not a perfect House Speaker by any stretch of the imagination, but he's, you know, upright and can get out there and sticks to his talking points and went out there and was regularly giving people updates. Joe Biden, as we've listeners know, is 80 years old and only works from 10 to 4, 5 days a week. You know, who do you think is going to win the messaging war in that competition? And in that light, how much better do you think Biden's messaging is going to be a year from now when he's on the campaign trail? Probably not much better, probably no better than what we saw. So I think that's the most interesting and kind of, you know, significant aspect of what we saw over the past week or two is just how little Biden could get out there and defend what he was doing there. On the substance of the bill, it's fine. It amounts to, because of the rate of inflation, the, you know, keeping it flat for 1 year and then going up 1% means that non-defense, non-discretionary spending is, the government's going to have less purchasing power because of this, because it's below the rate of inflation. The bad news is defense is also in that same ballpark, which is not great because Republicans wanted to increase defense spending. You know, they got some symbolic wins, the work requirements, the IRS funding, not all, but some of it's, you know, the clawing back some of the COVID spending. For people who want to say, this is nowhere near as good as it should have been, and that sellout McCarthy, blah, blah, blah. I kind of like, well, they only got one house of Congress. They don't have the Senate. They don't have the White House. Like, you really want to see spending cuts, you need a Republican Senate. You need a Republican White House. And it's worth noting, this is a better deal than Republicans did have the House and the Senate and the White House during the first 2 years of the Trump presidency. Right. So for a party that didn't care about spending cuts not that long ago, getting this deal under Biden starts to look pretty good. And, you know, you avoid the consequence of the default on the debt and the economic consequences of that. The Biden administration punts on this cockamamie crazy 14th Amendment scheme. You know, this, all things considered, this is a pretty good outcome because I think the House majority needs a functioning U.S. economy as much as the Biden White House needs one. And so I think everybody gets to walk away from the table saying, yeah, we got some of the stuff we wanted, not everything we did. And it ends up looking a lot like previous debt ceiling, assuming it passes, and I think it will. It looks like previous debt ceiling negotiations and, you know, government shutdown fights and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's just crazy, though, to only really care about fiscal stuff and be willing to take it to the wall when you have a slim majority and one chamber of Congress and don't control the White House anymore. But you don't care about it when you have unified control of government. That's the outrage. This deal is not the outrage. That's the outrage. But Noah, the way I look at this is as a debt ceiling deal, it's fine. It's about what you'd expect. Maybe Republicans got a little bit more than you would expect, or you could be actually really surprised on the upside if you assume they wouldn't be able to get their own house in order and unify enough to pass their own bill and end up getting a clean debt limit stuffed down their throat. That wasn't a crazy scenario. It was possible. So it's much better than that. But then if you look at the entirety of our fiscal problem, this is a drop in the bucket at best. And there's some question whether the savings will actually materialize as advertised. So they're cutting IRS funding, which is great, but the IRS got one single appropriation with this new $80 billion infusion. So they're just going to move back or move ahead some future spending to spend the same amount now as they wanted to anyway. And then the $20 billion that was cut will provide more headroom for more spending elsewhere in the budget. Apparently the same thing is going to happen with the unspent COVID funds. Obviously, entitlements were off the table. Other things were off the table. So this is not solving our fiscal problems, but as a debt ceiling in this moment is not bad.
Well, you said it. It wasn't designed to address our fiscal problems because the primary drivers of the federal debt were off the table to begin with. And we're never going to talk about entitlements, and those are the biggest. We were only talking about discretionary spending, and not even all discretionary spending. Trying to keep military off the table, so it was just generally about trimming around the edges. I read the New York Times write up of the IRS's cut from $20 billion of the $80 billion that were appropriated for it in the so called Inflation Reduction Act, and the Times was insistent upon the deleterious effect this would have on tax collection, even though the IRS itself was saying no. No, we're going to be fine. It's not going to affect our operations whatsoever. And the Times was trying to correct them to no avail. As Jim alluded to, you know, if you have a problem with this agreement, you know, the remedy for that is to win more elections than you have. If you want more leverage at the negotiating table, that the source of that is the legitimacy that voters confer on you in elections. But Republicans, and I've heard, for example, Chip Roy say, well, we sacrificed all our leverage on the border. You know, now we didn't get anything in the border here, and I don't even remember when that was on the table. So you could really open the aperture and think of all the opportunities that were missed in this very narrow agreement over some very narrow conditions. But Democrats started from a position of saying, you'll get nothing and like it. We're not even going to negotiate with you. We're not. This is a wholly illegitimate enterprise on your part, and we will not entertain it. And from there to here is a gigantic backing off of what they had initially hoped to accomplish. And it must come as a shock to the system of Democratic partisans who naively believed what their political leaders were assuring them, that they have all the authority. They control two of the three levers of power in Washington. There's no reason why we should have to capitulate here. And that they did, and that the White House took the lead on this, and Senate Democrats in particular ceded negotiations to the White House, knowing that they were going to get whatever they were going to get. And it was probably going to be unpalatable to their voters. Puts the White House in a really difficult position. They're now on the hook for having betrayed their own constituents by setting expectations they knew they could never meet. There could be a very long tail on the disappointment they've probably engendered in some of their most partisan voters.
So, MED, if we focus on the right, our friends on the right, especially Chip Roy, I mean, they're very sincere about fiscal stuff. Chip has been preaching this gospel and trying to fight this fight for a very long time. But if you just look at the sheer politics from their perspective, this isn't a bad outcome either. They, through the speaker fight, they got inside the tent. They had an influence on this process by helping forge this original bill that Kevin McCarthy passed. That set the predicate for the structure of this deal. Now, it fell short, obviously, on a lot of fronts. They were never going to get the RAINS Act. You know, they got some changes in the administrative procedure around regulations. They were never going to repeal all the Biden tax incentives and tax credits for green energy. But the structure of this, you know, if you look at the boxes, there was an attempt to check every box at least a little bit. And now they're not going to have to vote for it either. You know, so it looks like Democrats will produce the votes. So it's not a terrible outcome for the conservatives in the caucus.
No, not at all. And I think they end up making McCarthy look like a winner in the process. I mean, in a way, like, in a way, there's a comment by Liam Donovan, a Republican strategist who tweets a lot about this process on Twitter that struck me and is worth sharing, which is that, you know, we're also accustomed to the unthinkable and the bizarre and the truly strange over the last 7 years, that we have trouble recognizing and accepting what is just normal. And in a way, this debt ceiling deal was a sign of normality returning, right? I mean, it's about what you would expect if you just, in theory, had a Republican House dealing with a Democratic Senate and a Democratic president. And, you know, Republicans only get a little bit of a say, but they get a little bit of a say. And they only get it if they can hang together, which they did. So this is like a surprisingly normal thing. And I think it serves McCarthy well. I think it serves Joe Biden well, too. You know, this is a Democratic Party that's coming off of, you know, a bender on spending. I mean, 2 years ago, we were talking about figures like $6 trillion. Less than 2 years ago, we were talking about $6 trillion in spending and, you know, plans to transform the entire economy for the Green New Deal. Now we're just talking about, like, something real, not reformist the way conservatives want on entitlements, but, you know, a little cut here to non-defense discretionary spending and some work requirements. That's normality if I've ever seen it.
Exit question to you, Jim Garrity. Describe Kev McCarthy using one, I repeat, one of these words: magician, operator, survivor, buccaneer, weakling.
Rich, I can't believe you do. Oh, buccaneer. Oh, okay. All right. With a B. All right. That makes more sense. When you were looking for an adjective, I was going to say competent. So I guess operator comes closest to that, that this was basically, you know, this is a pretty good deal considering the limited leverage he had. If the day comes when there's a Republican Senate and a Republican president, we will expect a great deal more from him. But considering the limited leverage he started with, the small House majority, and the difficulty becoming Speaker in the beginning of this process, so far, presuming they pass it all, this is looking like a pretty good outcome from where he started.
All right, MBD, we have Operator on the board. Magician, Operator, Survivor, Buccaneer, Weakling.
Buccaneer.
Whoa.
Yeah, I'm going to give it to him. I mean, firstly, it's a Buccaneer is someone who takes risks, and taking the speakership itself was a big risk, especially under the circumstances in which he inherited it. And he's achieving something with it. So yeah, no, I think there's a sense of adventure and purpose around Kevin McCarthy all of a sudden.
Whoa! So Noah, MBD's gone all the way to Buccaneer again. Magician, Operator, Survivor, Buccaneer, Weakling.
I'm gonna retreat back to Operator, only because the outcome of this thing was going to rest on Democratic votes, and you could see that coming. And it gives his restive members of his conference room to inveigh against the results of a deal that is actually pretty good. The Republicans have a lot more terrain to retreat to here than Democrats did, and it was handled really effectively and smoothly in the mechanics of it. So, yeah, back to Operator.
So I'm going to say Survivor, but obviously with Operator mixed in, and just a touch, I'm not going Buccaneer, but a touch of Magician. And it's been a really good couple of months, early going, but it's been impressive work by Kevin McCarthy, given the constraints of a very small and what you would have thought would have been extremely fractious majority, but hasn't been so fractious, at least so far. Maybe there's more fractiousness to come. Anyway, with that, let's hear from our first sponsor of this episode. I want to tell everyone about a new podcast from our friends at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. It's called Free the Economy. It's about how we can all be happier, healthier, and wealthier in a world with less government control. From legalizing the gig economy to the perils of ESG and what true diversity in the workplace looks like, each week CEI's Free the Economy podcast brings you up to speed on news you can use and welcomes experts in their field to have honest and candid conversations about how these policies and more shape our economy and society. America has the greatest economy in the world, but it could be even stronger if we embraced a free society where innovation and entrepreneurship were encouraged and not shackled with bureaucratic controls. Check out Free the Economy wherever you listen to podcasts or visit cei.org/freetheeconomy, cei.org/freetheeconomy. So MBD, as you know, and as listeners know who listened to our last episode, I was quite down on the DeSantis announcement. I have to say his interviews since then have been quite good. He's knowledgeable, he's cogent, and importantly, we talked about this a little bit last time, it's become even more evident, he's not afraid to take on Trump. Now, he's doing it in a measured way, a careful way. I was very struck with about an 11-minute interview he had with Ben Shapiro, where Ben asked about the 2020 election, and the assumption from DeSantis was that it was rigged. He didn't really use that word himself, but he talked about Zuckerbucks and talked about the changes being made last minute in election procedures, which obviously was true. Blamed Trump for this because he said a lot of the out-of-control Fauciism accounted for the changes in how the voting was occurring. Yeah. Said in Florida, they don't have vote harvesting or any of this other nonsense. But if you're in states that has lots of early voting and mail-in voting, he said you can't tell your voters not to take advantage of it. It's just crazy and just hurts yourself. So this is a way of hitting Trump on the election, again, in a measured way, not the way any of us probably would say it, not the way Chris Christie is going to say it. We can talk about him a little bit, this segment too. Indications are he's going to get into the race. And then you've had this all-out war on Twitter, where the very combative DeSantis press person, Christine Pshaw, who's usually hell on the legacy media, has been hell on these Trump pro-Trump accounts. There's one called Cat Turd that I've taken to paying attention to because they're interesting memes and you know you need to know what this segment of the internet is thinking. And she and others had pushed him so far. He's like, I can tell they just don't want our – DeSantis doesn't want our support if he's a nominee. So here you have the Never DeSantis movement growing and the extreme Trump precincts of Twitter. What do you make of it?
I mean, it's kind of fun. The Twitter stuff is kind of fun in that, you know, Cat Turd and the like remind me of the, they remind me a little bit of the Hillary partisans late in the Obama-Hillary race, the Pumas, Party Unity, my, well, you could probably finish the phrase yourself. You know, listen, this has been good fun. It's been, I think, reassuring to conservatives and Republicans who want to move on from Trump that DeSantis is attacking Trump. I think it's also reassuring that he's doing it in a measured way so far because you want to save the big dramatics for the big audiences. You know, a big clash over January 6th or a really hell for lather line on Fauci, that needs to be saved for the proper moment in the debates or, you know, some heated exchange ahead of the, right ahead of the primaries that people remember. But for now, he's just counterpunching. And that is a sign of life after you've had 5 months of Donald Trump just pouring buckets of piss on DeSantis all throughout this time and hurting DeSantis' numbers nationally with that rainfall. So yeah, it's a good sign of life. I think all of his attacks also have the benefit of being cogent. The real trick, though, is that eventually they'll have to be sharp and memorable, right? Mm-hmm. It's like right now DeSantis is very... He's appealing to... he's very appealing to people like us, right?
Yeah.
Who love the laying out the case.
Yeah, that's the problem. I always like candidates who appeal to people like us, and it never works out.
No, but I mean, you know, he is just, you know, he reads constantly, and he sometimes talks in paragraphs.
He does. He talks in paragraphs all the time.
And so, you know, that's an admirable reflection of his intellect. But at some point he also has to demonstrate, you know, the quality that I think attracts a lot of Republican voters to Trump, which I've called willfulness in a lot of columns. Yeah. I think that's the key.
Yeah. So I think sharp and memorable would be important. Also, he's delivering these lines in non-hostile settings. And when you're on a debate stage is not going to be quite as easy. You'll have moderators and other candidates, say, on the 2020 election trying to push you off the balance you're trying to strike. But Noah, have you been encouraged by early DeSantis or am I being too rosy here?
I have been encouraged by DeSantis's early rollout following the rollout. So the initial foray into you know, presidential politics left a lot to be desired.
Yeah, ridiculous.
But in the interim, he's definitely made up for it, made that something of a memory by flooding the zone with a lot of, as you say, friendly interviews, but nevertheless doing what is expected of him, which is to take it very much to Donald Trump. That interview with Ben was just hammering him left and right. Attacks. He's attacking me from the left. He amnestied 2 million illegal immigrants. He signed the First Step Act, which I opposed in its first final iteration. COVID lockdowns, and of course the omnibus. Which back to our discussion about the debt ceiling. A future president, DeSantis, might be in a much better position as a result of this debt ceiling deal because it makes the process of appropriations easier, and you won't have these monstrous omnibus bills that Donald Trump was compelled to sign on a semi-regular basis. Those are technical issues, but all together, in the aggregate, they amount to a real serious attack on the guy's record as president, which we have not heard yet from candidates, and certainly not from Ron DeSantis. So going from a standing stop in relative terms, yes, he's shown more than signs of life and demonstrated the capacity to get in the heads of Donald Trump supporters, including Donald Trump. The former president is on defensive today in response to Rob DeSantis.
Yeah, where's Rob? Does anyone understand where Rob comes from?
Incomprehensible. It's just this Trumpian cant that you can't actually decipher.
I assume it's just insulting to mess up someone's name. Is that the idea? Like to not really know someone's name?
It is a mystery. But the term, in substance, he's saying, listen, I was saying that we should go after Disney earlier, and Ron DeSantis presided over Disney's descent into wokeism, and I've always been on the right side of this issue, and the fact is that he's not. And now there's some real under-the-radar still, but nevertheless threatens to become much more public, back and forth between the DeSantis camps and the Trump camps over who's more in bed with Disney and whether the Trump campaign is benefiting financially from its ties to Bob Iger, for example. And that's a real primary issue. It doesn't really escape the dynamics of primary politics. But it's a real live issue, and it's thrown Donald Trump on the defensive, which is a position he rarely occupies. And I think you got to give the DeSantis camp credit for getting aggressive enough to put him on his back feet.
Yeah, so Jim, another thing, people are irritated about this aspect of DeSantis. He's clearly kind of been maneuvering with an eye to this for a very long time. But in this campaign, he needs to go on the Eric Bolling show on Newsmax, which probably none of us watch, and get a respectful hearing and be able to make the case to that audience. And I didn't watch the entirety of his early interview with Bolling, but I saw clips, and he, you know, the whole Bolling thing is like, you're what do you make of these critiques? Your establishment is Karl Rove secretly running your campaign? And he needs to be able to push back against that with credibility, which I think he did. But Jim, my question though is, do you think the Twitter wars matter? Certainly, all the players think they do. I mean, they're really intensely invested in these fights. They do litigate various issues, sometimes very, very early compared to when they break through in the mainstream discourse. But then we all, you know, we all repeat the cliche that Twitter isn't real life.
Well, before we go any further, Rich, I want to go all the way back to the beginning of this segment when you said that after feeling near catastrophic panic at the debut of DeSantis and the Twitter spaces and the tech snafus and all that stuff, you were really convinced that was about as bad a start to this campaign as possible. Now you're feeling better about it. Am I characterizing your was there anyone telling you at that time not to worry?
I saw this one coming, where you're going from a mile away, Jim. Yeah.
To quote the wisest philosopher in the history of Western civilization, Aaron Rodgers, RELAX. It was, it was a really lousy start, but already here we are. It's May 30th. And I feel like it already, I jokingly said this morning, wasn't that 10 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody's talking about Twitter spaces anymore. Everybody who wants to see and hear Ron DeSantis is going to be able to see and hear Ron DeSantis. And what's going to matter is what he's saying in these interviews. And I think he's doing, obviously something is better than nothing, rather than, clicks and static and stuff like that. So yeah, this is, this is a good start, or, we'll see. It's probably going to take a while for it to catch fire. It's probably going to take a while before we see any change in the polling numbers. But I think this is, it's been after that, the rollout has gotten back on track and is going the way the DeSantis campaign would like it to. As for the question of whether this Twitter stuff matters, my argument is that it doesn't matter, but there's a giant asterisk next to it, which is it matters to the extent the arguments you see in this Twitter mudslinging food fight that was going on all Memorial Day weekend, full of contentions that Ron DeSantis' military service is like that of Pete Buttigieg and therefore meaningless or insignificant. Or Laura Loomer's a nut job. But the idea that Laura Loomer's running around saying, how do we know Casey DeSantis had cancer? Screw you. We do not need that in our politics. That is some horse pucky, and there are other words I could use there. So to the extent, I think Ron DeSantis has enough wherewithal and good judgment to know you don't want to go within 10 feet of any type of arguments like this against Trump. I don't know if Trump has that same good judgment. And mm-hmm. we all saw for the last few years, Trump would retweet things that were, you know, Ted Cruz's wife is ugly and, you know, stuff that was really beyond the pale. And then it would say, well, Trump didn't say it. He only retweeted it, which, you know, and retweets right. aren't always, you know, getting into that kind of, yeah. you know, arguing about the number of angels that can hit on, you know, fit on yeah, the head of a pin. The
Ted Cruz wife thing, that was a retweet, right?
Yeah. And so the question was, did Trump say it? Or was Trump merely repeating right. it? You know, what's the right metaphor for when, you know, you retweet something? Clearly, like, if Trump disagreed with it, he would not have retweeted that, you know. But this is also, like, the mantra of Trump. And I think what you guys were saying about him not, not using the right name, it's a sign of disrespect. By the way, don't think of it that way when I call you Greg on this podcast.
Yeah. I know how Rob feels.
Yeah. That this is, you know, the Trump's attitude of the kitchen sink. And we see this nonsensical argument that DeSantis is a Johnny come lately to the Disney fight, but somehow he's the cause of Disney getting, well, you know, none of it ever makes any sense. And I kind of feel like at the core of Trump is to put out this kind of like directly contradictory one sentence after another. DeSantis isn't tough enough on Disney the way I was. Never mind that a week ago, you know, or 2 weeks ago, Trump was saying, why are you picking on Disney? Coupled with the, oh, and DeSantis is why Disney is woke. That this is kind of just an assertion of his worldview over reality. And the question is, how many Trump supporters say, yes, Ron DeSantis is an enthusiastic supporter of the Disney Corporation? You know, Ron DeSantis is an enthusiastic supporter of wokeness, right? These are crazy nonsense, get you in the straitjacket type perspectives. But that's what, you know, Trump wants to put out there to muddy the waters. And hopefully some people will say, yeah, you know, DeSantis always was good friends with Bob Iger, you know. To muddy this as much as possible, to basically make the idea that 2 + 2 = 5, and Trump can be the tough one on Disney and not DeSantis.
Yeah, what I thought was interesting over the weekend, Jim, as far as I could tell, the whole thing about DeSantis's military service was kind of created by the DeSantis people. Because I went and tried to look back and see, so where's this attack on DeSantis's military service? Where did it originate from? And as far as I could tell, it was Liz Harrington, who's a Trump flack, saying, you know, in some interview, OAN or something, DeSantis isn't in it for the country. And then the DeSantis people use that. Oh, so you're attacking yep. his military service. And then they tweet yep. out all the pictures of him, you know, graduating and, you know, in front of a Humvee in Iraq. So that seemed really clever. And then also there was a statement from the Never Back Down PAC, which is the DeSantis PAC from over the weekend. DeSantis had a barbecue, I think, in Tallahassee with members of the military and their families, maybe Gold Star families. And they had a quote from someone who was there, a serviceman. And he said, this is so great that DeSantis cared so much about us. He met with us for a long time. He listened to every single story. And especially notable, he added in this quote in the emailed press release, that this same day, Donald Trump was playing golf with the golf tournament backed by the Saudis, who had a huge hand in September 11th. So that was totally gratuitous. You know, I'm not saying using that in the negative connotation, but in the sense they just didn't have to do that. And they took that shot. They went out of their way to take that shot. So MBD, question to you.
Rich, can I just jump in? One thing, just observe.
Yeah.
What you're pointing out there is that on any given day, there are like five different groups that can speak on behalf of a presidential candidate. One is the candidate himself. The second is the campaign and the official spokesman. The third one is the independent PACs. And then you've got these two blurrier areas, the online supporters, like the folks who have endorsed the candidate and who are seen as being in the loop of the campaign, but are not like officially on staff. And then you got Twitter randos who say that they're, you know, supporters. There is going to be a concerted effort between now and the end of the primaries to blur the lines amongst these five groups as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to hear, the DeSantis people are saying, well, the DeSantis people might be the campaign, might be official spokesman, or it might just be any old person who says they support DeSantis, and yet somehow DeSantis is expected to be held responsible for that. Same dynamic with Trump.
So MBD, what do you think, where does this leave Chris Christie? I would say that if DeSantis were just totally ducking Trump, then there's a rationale for Christie. He's not. He's clearly not afraid of the fight, even if you might want it, depending on where you stand, you might want it to be a more forthright case against Trump. But Christie appears to be in. His supporters have started a PAC. There's a New York Times story today, we're recording Tuesday morning, about how Christie had some organizational questions that apparently have been resolved in his own mind, and it sounds like he's in.
Yeah, so here's the thing. DeSantis, you noted that DeSantis has been critiquing Trump's record as president, and that's exactly right. He's been saying, like, well, we don't have the wall built, or, you know, he did Fauciism for too long, or he locked down the nation for too long, and that hurt the economy. I think that is a deliberate way of getting around the problem, which is that most Republicans like both Trump and DeSantis. Like, when you mm-hmm. look at the favorability rating, basically, like, 4 out of 5 Republicans like both of these men. And I think that's a way of criticizing him and distinguishing yourself from Trump without doing what I think Chris Christie is going to do, and the trap that Chris Christie may fall into, which is criticizing Trump in a way that reminds Republican voters of hysterical left-wing attacks on Trump, right? Like, earlier this month, Chris Christie called Trump a puppet of Putin. And it's just like, that is going to go right into the mental category of Chris Christie is a Russiagate moron for a lot of Republican voters. And they're going to find it very easy to dismiss that line of criticism. I think Chris Christie could be getting boxed out here by Ron DeSantis, the way DeSantis is carefully and more methodically going at Trump's record in a way that doesn't feel hysterical or emotionally incontinent, in a way that's, you know, in a sense, respectful of what conservatives liked about Trump, because conservatives liked a lot of Trump's mm-hmm. policy ambitions in the end. And yeah, I think Christie could be making a mistake here.
So, Noah, X question to you, sticking with Christie, assuming Chris Christie gets in the race, he will destroy Donald Trump, destroy Ron DeSantis, or none of the above?
Probably none of the above. I struggle to see the rationale for Chris Christie's entry into the race to begin with, particularly in part for the reasons that Michael described there. The logic of his run for the White House is going to compel him to train more fire on DeSantis than Donald Trump, if he's serious about emerging as the nominee and displacing the most valid, viable Trump alternative. That's been the dynamic since 2016. And there's a reason why it's the most durable dynamic. Is it's just the fastest pathway to the nomination, to in order to have this 2-on-2 race that nobody ever gets. Christie tried out attacking Ron DeSantis. It didn't seem to work. So he seems to have trained most of his fire on Donald Trump, but none of it's landing. And for the reasons I think probably Michael describes. Now, maybe his attacks will have some sort of psychological effect, like it'll just embed themselves deep in the Republican subconscious and become, in a Socratic way, their own impression of the guy. But it's hard to see that happening now. He's going to make a go of it, but I don't think he's going to destroy anyone.
So, Jim, let me refine this exit question, because I now realize it is much too obvious. I'm not too prideful to make these exit questions an iterative process. Trial and error, Jim. Very, very, very important. We wouldn't have Western civilization as it currently exists without having all due respect for trial and error. So let me ask a different version to you. Chris Christie, if he gets in the race, will end up hurting more Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis? See, I made you think.
Yeah, I think it entirely depends on how Chris Christie sees his role, what strategy. He's capable of hurting either one of them. I have heard surprisingly persistent rumors that Chris Christie and Ron DeSantis are quiet allies. that, you know, there's a lot of stories that Chris Christie wanted to be attorney general in the Trump administration. Jared Kushner made sure that would not happen for Christie's sin of prosecuting his father. And Chris Christie was effectively shut out of the Trump administration. And the theory goes that Chris Christie would really like to be attorney general in a Ron DeSantis administration. And he's going to jump into the race and he's going to hammer at Trump. And he's just going to basically run a kamikaze run at Trump and just tear him down in every debate appearance possible. And DeSantis will win the nomination. DeSantis wins the presidency. And he puts Chris Christie in the attorney general slot. I don't know how much I buy that rumor. Because Chris Christie, if it's a secret deal, Chris Christie's hiding it really well by insisting that Ron DeSantis has no charisma and that he's terrible and that he's weak and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Wow, he's really, you know, don't bury yourself in the role, pal. So my suspicion is that Chris Christie is not in some secret deal with Ron DeSantis. He really does think very poorly of Ron DeSantis. And Chris Christie believes there's only one man who could save this country. And he sees them every morning when he looks in the mirror.
Yeah. So MBD, I can't believe there's any such deal or even implicit arrangement for the reasons Jim cited at the end. MBD, hurt Trump or hurt DeSantis more?
I'm afraid he's going to hurt DeSantis more. I think he is going to be testy with DeSantis, and he's going to repeat attacks on DeSantis's record, you know, from the right. You know, he's going to critique him as like not really conservative because he's using state power to go after businesses, or you know, he used state authority to tell school districts what to do during the pandemic, or, you know, things along that line. Right. So, yeah, I just think he's going to end up hurting DeSantis more in the end.
Yeah, I think hurt DeSantis more. I mean, there's something to be said, obviously, for getting that full-throated case against Trump. He is desperately lying about 2020 and spreading conspiracy theories and is unfit to serve. This is a critique you can make of DeSantis. You know, something that Trump has always realized, although he pays a lot of attention to polls, is that you can change public opinion. And you can critique DeSantis, maybe he's just accommodating current Republican opinion too much, and Christie's going to go out and try to change it. But I think, you know, he's telling himself he's in it to win it, which means same dynamic will apply to him as everyone else who's running behind DeSantis, which is you got to get ahead of DeSantis and try to tear down DeSantis. And Christie is a very talented guy, a very charismatic guy, and can be devastating on the attack, as we saw with the infamous Marco Rubio debate in New Hampshire. So I'm also going to go with hurt DeSantis.
I will say though, Rubio cooperated with that hit in a way.
You mean helped him a lot?
Yeah, of course. By the way
he handled it, yeah.
By totally melting down. I mean, you know, he was under pressure from Christie, but. You know, you had to adjust. Once Christie accuses you of using stock lines, you have to drop your stock lines.
Yeah, exactly. No, I remember my story from that is I talked to a Rubio guy that day, late that afternoon. I was like, you know, so how are you guys feeling about the debate? You know, Christie's going to come after you hammer and tongs. He's like, oh, don't worry, Rich. We got the perfect answer tailored. It pushes back just enough without being defensive. It's perfect. And I don't know, maybe it wasn't so perfect, but repeating it a couple times made it even less so. A cruise person that day told me, yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry, there's a trap here to going after Donald Trump on matters of character, is that he can appear bigger than you too. Mm-hmm. If you attack him on issues of character and go as low as he's willing to go, because if he doesn't match your energy, all of a sudden he emerges the quiet statesman. Mm-hmm. And he's had a couple of those surprising showings.
That's
where
right.
He actually appears like he's above the fray. So there's more risk in that strategy than I think even Christie's backers have entertained.
So no, we have this really sad spectacle of Dianne Feinstein. She was not in great shape prior to this latest illness, shingles, which is nothing to fool around with, especially if you're older. She's back in Washington now after a fairly long absence where her presence was really needed by Democrats on the Judiciary Committee. She wasn't there. There was talk of trying to replace her, but you need Republican cooperation to do that. And of course, they weren't going to cooperate. And you've had people saying she should resign. You've had people saying, no, it's sexist to have her resign. And she's just clearly just incapable now of carrying out the office. But there she is trying to do it anyway.
Yeah, and it matters insofar as it's lit a fire under the political press because of the position she occupies on the Senate Judiciary Committee. There's a reason why nobody's going after John Fetterman for his aphasia in the same way, and it's not because of this deep well of sympathy for John Fetterman's condition. He's a reliable presser of a button that he's told to press. Dianne Feinstein's absence on the committee actually stalled the work of the committee for a couple of weeks. At least when it comes to controversial nominees where you need everybody present. And there has been this rather craven attempt to blame this on Republicans, as if Republicans would somehow block. They blocked her from being temporarily removed from her committee assignment in favor of Ben Cardin from Maryland. But if she were to resign and be replaced, the conference would be able to, or the caucus would be able to replace her on Judiciary and the work would get done. They can't because she's not resigning. And she just doesn't feel like she has to. And maybe she doesn't, even though it's hurting her party. She's on the way out, and California's politics are what they are. But it does, between her and John Fetterman, and the president, who has a noted tendency now to just become lost in the fog of his own mind when he's speaking extemporaneously, it does create the cumulative appearance of a party that is rapidly deteriorating before our eyes, that they struggle with cognition. Some of their most prominent members, who are right in our face, are demonstrating this. And you're being told by the arbiters of American political discourse that none of this is happening, and it's kind of illegitimate that it's even being noticed. And that's just an insult to your intelligence. It's part of the reason why, I think, we're seeing such discontent with Joe Biden in particular from his party, not because he's been an incompetent president. If you look at his record on paper, it's not all that terrible. It's that he's an incompetent steward, an ineffective steward of the brand. The brand is suffering as a result of its agedness. And you see a little bit of that apprehension in the press, but not nearly enough, given the scale of the challenge before them. It's not just organizational. It's not just Dianne Feinstein who's preventing you from passing really controversial judicial nominees. This is showing up in the polls in many ways that I don't think folks really recognize, at least in the political class, really recognize the degree to which it is because the brand of a youthful, energetic Democratic Party that appeals to the most committed activists in our politics is sort of fading away.
So MBD, these folks, very few of them, they're exceptions, but very few of them know when it's time to go, and there's not any mechanism for forcing them to go, and it creates this real problem. Obviously, we're seeing it with Feinstein, who's really an incredibly impressive career. I mean, it's you skim past her electoral history on Wikipedia, and it is extensive. She was a formidable figure in her prime. Obviously, don't share her politics, but a very serious person. And now there's this. I remember, though, when I was a young Cub reporter down in Washington, D.C., meeting Strom Thurmond in the hallways of Congress, and he was pretty out of it. And he would just go from one person to the other, and he was sort of a natural glad hander. But he would prop himself up on your arms, you know, while greeting you, and then, you know, greet you, and then move on to the next person. You know, that was a version of his walker in the halls of the Senate. But I understand these are the best jobs, you know, any of these people are ever going to have. And then there's this real human phenomenon. You've done this your whole life. You quit. You're going to die probably, you know, in fairly short order. At least that's the risk. You kind of lose a sense of purpose. I remember Bill Buckley when he was getting up there meeting with some of us and saying, should I stop writing my column? You know, maybe it's not as good as it used to be. And one of my colleagues saying, no, Bill, don't stop. You'll die if you stop. Don't stop. And I think some of these people feel that.
Yeah, I actually think that's the major motivator, is that they don't have like a plan, you know, they don't have like a plan they're looking forward to, right? A retirement plan that excites them. You know, holding on to this power and this office, you know, people are jealous of it. It also, I think, reflects for us, I think, you know, their American life has shifted dramatically in its view of old age as people are living longer, and many more people are living longer into a period of dementia or Alzheimer's, where, you know, instead of just granting most of our elderly the dignity of their old age and saying, well, they have wisdom and they have, you know, so much experience, and the passions of their youth have cooled to where their judgment is now totally refined. We now look at people over 75 or over 80 and start to wonder when they will lose it, lose it entirely. And our institutions have never really, you know, reckoned with that. Like, I mean, our Constitution sets an age floor for the presidency, but we have nothing like an age limit. And you see other institutions struggling with this, like the papacy itself, right? The previous pope retired out of fear that he would, like his predecessor, suffer a severely mentally degenerative but long-term decline. So I think this is something that, you know, the Senate might, or the Congress might be forced to look at eventually, is like, should we have some kind of retirement age? And that's something that is public and let people know and begin setting a norm for people to prepare themselves to relinquish these offices.
So, Jim, obviously, as Noah alluded to, the big elephant in the room here is Biden. There's one thing to be a senator who's increasingly debilitated and now is basically incapable of serving. It's another thing to have a president of the United States in that situation. Biden is not in that situation currently, but the things to be concerned about are growing. You know, they're mumbly, weird, verbal wanderings all the time. There was this near stumble in the G7 summit when he was coming down some steps in Japan, and he righted himself, and that's fine, and everyone could just ignore it. But we were inches away from disaster there. I mean, he could have fallen down two or three concrete steps in a way that would have been just horrible and lots of ways. And Democrats are going to be teetering on that metaphorical precipice from now until November 2024, assuming that Biden is actually the candidate. And I think it plays a lot into just the horrific polling. I mean, just astonishing. We've talked about this a little bit, but, you know, losing about 30% in the primary vote to Robert Kennedy Jr. and Marianne Williamson. And then you had this CNN poll that said that, 66% of Americans say a Biden second term would be either a setback or a disaster for the country.
Let's go, Biden 2024! first on Feinstein, and we should note that, like, she's been losing her memory and having troubles and insisting she had not said something the day she had said the day before, like, for several years now. This is not something that suddenly came on her. The New York Times, you know, piece that came out Sunday said she doesn't remember how to vote. She doesn't remember how the Senate functions. She needs her staff to help her with the most basic function. Like, it's now well beyond that. It's now not even memory's not as good as it used to be. And, you know, for the first year or two of Biden's presidency, I noticed that you were allowed to talk about Biden's age if you use certain euphemisms. He's lost a little speed on his fastball. You know, if you describe it gently, it was a legitimate topic. If you just openly said the president's too old to do the job, people like Chris Saliza would accuse you of the lowest bottom feeding politics.
You're never going to forget that, are you, Jim?
Never, never. I'll be in the retirement home when I, you know, Irish Alzheimer's. I forget everything but a grudge. So, like with Feinstein, it's like it's sad. This is a woman who belongs in a rest home. She doesn't remember what she's doing from minute to minute. She should not be a U.S. senator. Now, in a normal political world, what would happen is that a trusted friend figure, someone with the, you know, kind of authority would, you know, sit down with Dianne Feinstein and say, Dianne, I love you, but it's time to hang it up. You can't do the job the way you used to, and it's starting to hurt your state. It's starting to hurt your constituents. This isn't the way you want your career to end. You know, everyone's still going to love you. Everyone's still going to appreciate everything you did over the years, but it's time to sit down and pass the torch to the younger generation. By the way, for all we know, it's entirely possible that Dianne Feinstein has already agreed to retire several times and forgotten every time. That's not a joke. I genuinely wonder how much she, like whether they have these conversations and she leans in a certain direction and then things move on. And she doesn't, decides not to. She doesn't remember that conversation. But anyway, so that's the state of things. Joe Biden can't make that conversation. Can't have that conversation with her. The moment Joe Biden says you're getting too old for the job, it's time for you to retire. Dianne Feinstein, whatever state she's in, can still turn around and shoot back. You first. Mm-hmm. You know, who are you to tell me I'm too old to do this job? What I find fascinating, you know how we talk, like if you look back on the history of the last decade, the White House Correspondents' Dinner in 2010 might have been really significant because not only was that on the eve of the Bin Laden strike, but you know, Obama from the podium was making fun of Trump, just mocking him mercilessly over the birther stuff and all that kind of stuff. And people have speculated, and people have said that you know Trump decided to run because of that. That really stuck in Trump's craw. By the way, notice he has the exact same Irish Alzheimer's that I just said that I have. So now you kind of wonder. Joe Biden's selection of Kamala Harris in the summer of 2020 may have been that first domino that put a whole bunch of things into that. Because first of all, remember how much when Biden was running in 2020 that there was never explicitly said, but he said, I might serve one term, I might serve two terms. And there were like multiple Biden associates quoted on background saying, yes, this is a one-term presidency. He's a bridge presidency. He's going to be passing the torch to a younger Democrat. And here we are. And Democrats do not believe that Kamala Harris can beat either Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis. And as much as they're going to deny that, if they thought she could, they'd be calling for her to run in 2024. The fact that there's not a single Democrat saying Biden is too old, it's time for Kamala Harris to take over, is an indicator they don't think she can beat either one of them, which is where we are.
So MBD, exit question to you. Assuming Joe Biden is the Democratic nominee, and assuming he loses one way or the other in 2024, your guess as to how much his age would play into such a defeat from 0 to 10, 0, no factor, 10, the entirety of the explanation of this hypothetical Joe Biden defeat, where are you, 0 to 10?
I'm at about a 5. I mean, I think it's it's tied together in ways that are hard to separate with assessments of his competence ever since mm-hmm. the Afghanistan withdrawal, right? That moment was when people decided, not that they hated his policies, but that he just was not capable of doing the job great. So, yeah, I'd say 5.
Noah?
I like 5 for that rationale. And we always stipulate that an incumbent president is a very hard target. And at this particular stage in his presidency, entering to the summer of the year before a re-election fight, is usually close to the nadir, at which point everybody says, oh, I've had enough of this guy. Then they start taking a look at the alternatives mm-hmm. and say, well, maybe I'm going to have some buyer's remorse if we were to change horses midstream, as it were. Take it all with a grain of salt. But there's, it would be foolish if Democrats whistled past the graveyard on all the signals they're receiving from the electorate and their own voters.
So, Jim Garrity, I'm going to average out the first two answers at 5. Did that computation on the fly. Where are you?
I want to give a non-5, so repeat the question.
So
I want to see how I can
assuming Biden loses in 24, what this hypothetical defeat rate the role that age will have played into it from 0 to 10. 0, not a factor. 10, the entirety of the explanation.
I'm going to raise it up to a 7. The country felt comfortable with Joe Biden being a heartbeat away in 2008, 2012. By the time Biden came back in the 2016 cycle, we could tell it wasn't the same guy. And there was this nonsense claim of, oh, it's a stutter, horse pucky. We watched this guy on our stage for vice president for years and Senate before then. He was garrulous. Someone might have a stutter. He didn't have a hard time getting his words out. He had a hard time stopping him from talking. That was the problem with Joe Biden. This guy is, you know, a much more aged guy. He looks frail. He looks like, God forbid, if he fell down the stairs like you were describing, he'd break a hip or break something worse. No, I think age is going to be a very big factor in this. And, you know, this is a reason this country has not had octogenarian presidents before.
I'm also going higher than 5. I would say a 6 versus Trump and a 7 or 8 versus DeSantis.
Yeah.
With that, let's hit a few other things before we go. Jim Garrity, you had a barbecue-a-thon over the Memorial weekend. Some of us had a barbecue, but you had a barbecue-a-thon.
It dawned on me as we're thinking about, you know, what are our lighter items going to be. This past weekend, for Memorial Day weekend, went up to the in-laws. We grilled for Saturday night's dinner, and that evening we had swordfish steaks, we had regular T-bone steaks, and we had ribs. And then before we left the next day, we had them again for lunch, not reheated. We put on new swordfish steaks, new T-bone steaks, new ribs. Then we came home, and yesterday for a Memorial Day cookout, it was a little bit rainy, but my wife and I together, we did regular burgers. Our friends brought over brats, and we heated up those. We did regular hot dogs, we heated up those. A grilled salmon, grilled vegetables. Yes, there has to be some green stuff on the plates, people. And veggie burgers. No, I did not consume any of the veggie burgers, but there were some guests who liked them. So you add that up. That's like 6 different things on the grill over the course of the day. And then you throw on top of it, I think I have, like, you know, personally utilized so much propane in the process of grilling all that stuff that the greens will be yelling at me for the rest of the year.
So, Noah, your weekend was marked not just by celebrations outside, but by a viral firestorm directed at your cover story and the new issue of NR.
I had just the loveliest weekend. We had a big party for the neighborhood on Saturday, and my brother and his friends were our house guests for the rest of the weekend. So it was all great. But the highlight was occasionally checking in on my phone just to see what was going on in the Twitterverse, and all the usual suspects, with the intellectual depth of a koi pond, the left opinion verse descended on this May 28th tweet featuring the cover article, my piece, The War on Things That Work, for which I'm eternally grateful to the magazine for promoting, and just unleashing a torrent of attacks on it that confirm the premise. There's this thing they do where they insist that, sometimes in the same tweet, insist that this isn't happening, this is all trash, hot garbage, and also it's really good that it's happening because the crisis is so grave that we have to actually do these kind of measures. So I couldn't have gotten a better promotion for the piece by affirming its conclusion, even though they don't seem to know that's what they were doing.
So, MBD, you've been delving even deeper into the work of Sean McMeekin.
Yeah, I was rereading Sean McMeekin's History of the Russian Revolution. McMeekin wrote a big revisionist World War II history called Stalin's War, which was kind of fascinating. He's probably like the right-wing revisionist historian of our time. And his work on the Russian Revolution, I think, pushes Pipes' insights even further than Pipes would. I mean, he really emphasizes, unlike Pipes, he emphasizes the role of luck and even the marginality of the communists early on. Whereas a lot of time people spend on the initial splits, McMeekin focuses on the failure of Russian liberals and the way that Russia's war state created the conditions.
It always comes down to the failure of liberals, doesn't it, MBD?
Well, I mean, in this case, it kind of does. I mean, they called for a war that ended up being a disaster for Russia, and then one that helped create the conditions by which the liberals would be marginalized forever. It's a great history, and it's really well written too. McMeekin is really skilled at making each chapter a coherent story.
So, totally randomly, the Lowry household has gotten into the Miami Heat. I hope wow. David French is not listening to this portion of the podcast, because I don't want him to think Jim Garrity style that he scored some points off of me, because finally I've come around to paying attention to the NBA. But this is how what a non-NBA guy I am. So I've been following a little bit on the ESPN app, the scores mostly. We watch some too. But it would be like 11 minutes into a quarter, and I'd be like, holy cow, we've gone almost 4 minutes without anyone scoring, and this quarter is crazy. And only like last night or the day before it, I realized they have 12-minute quarters in the NBA. I assume they're 15. They should be 15, but they're 12. And the Heat, you know, they barely got in. They lost their first play-in game. They're losing in the fourth quarter in their second play-in game, and then have just been astonishing ever since, starting with beating the Bucks soundly, and then they took this 3-0 lead against the Celtics. The Celtics, of course, came back. An amazing ending in Game 6, where the Celtics pulled a rabbit out of the hat, catalyzing all this really annoying coverage about how this would be the first 3-0 victory by any team in NBA history, hearkening back to the Red Sox in 2004. I saw interviews on ESPN with Johnny Damon and Pedro Martinez, so none of that was any fun. And then the Celtics just didn't show up in Game 7. They weren't hitting any threes, whereas the Heat was raining down threes on the Celtics, and are going astonishingly, amazingly into the finals. And this is just why one reason sports is so incredible. You literally never know. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
My pick is Andrew Fowler's piece.
Oh!
the Catholic Players Who Shape Baseball. This is obviously in light of the Dodgers inviting the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, a kind of grotesque anti-Catholic parody group, and honoring them for Pride Week or Pride Night or Pride Millennium. but Andrew goes through a lot of players throughout MLB history, and including the Dodgers organization, including the voice of the Dodgers, Vin Scully, who was very active in Catholic charities and even recorded a two-set CD of himself praying the rosary. And he points out that if Scully were still alive, the Dodgers probably never would have done this. And it's about the saddest sentence I read in the last month.
So, yeah, it was a great piece, although MBD, I'm tempted to write a rejoinder, the Episcopalian players who have influenced, shaped baseball. Noah, what's your pick?
Also from the magazine, sorry, Trump lost, via John McCormick. Some of these arguments might be familiar, but he dismantles many of the claims, especially those made in the Dinesh D'Souza documentary, 2000 Mules. It's an important reminder because we all constantly need to be reminded, apparently, of this fact, because it continues to be in doubt despite the utter absence of evidence in support of the pro-Trump contentions.
Jim Garrity, what's your pick?
Also from the magazine, Andy McCarthy's How the Bidens Got Rich. I go back and forth about whether the Roman Gen art for this piece works so well, because on the one hand, it's a terrific caricature of Joe Biden as Don Corleone. On the other hand, Don Corleone is like scary and badass and tough looking, and that's not something Biden usually looks like. But it just kind of lays out in typical, detailed, succinct, and clear Andy McCarthy fashion the amount of money coming in from foreign businessmen to the Bidens, going back for, you know, not just this since his, you know, presidency, but vice presidency and in the senatorial days. And it's just kind of like mind-boggling the degree to which, if you like, how did this not generate enormous outrage amongst Democrats, never mind from amongst Republicans who already have this kind of this, and why are so many people willing to basically kind of shrug it off and say, ah, you know? And my feeling was that most people, almost everybody in Washington has some idiot nephew who they end up giving a job answering phones or something like that. Washington's kind of used to that kind of taking care of your family that way. And with the Bidens, there was just never any limiting principle. So it just grew and grew and expanded year by year. So you end up taking millions of dollars from international companies that are, you know, close ties to the Chinese state. Anyway, good job, Andy.
So my pick is Ari Blythe's piece on the latest sales numbers from Bud Light. And I'm picking this as a way of recognizing all of our Bud Light coverage, both in print and on video, which has been quite extensive. But this is just, it's just amazing. It keeps going down. Second week of May, down 28.4%, which is just this NBD I was mentioning you in an episode or two ago that you said they might just, Bud Light might not cease to exist, you know, a couple months ago. And I was skeptical, but you gotta kind of wonder. I mean, there's also a story they're buying back Bud Light from wholesalers at a discount, or buying back expired beer that they can't get rid of. It's really amazing. So anyway, that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes it sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Noah. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to Free the Economy, the podcast from CEI. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors, and we'll see you next time.